I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The problem with feeling good, sometimes you want to feel better. And that's what I realized. I felt good. I wanted to feel better. What was that better going to look like? What drug could take me to that better? So beside our LSD parties and all this and things like that, and I still would take a little bit of that. And the old days was called Quaaludes. But all the along, remember, I am the director of high school guidance and the soccer coach. I sat in a tent. In a tent with the Indians smoking peyote and drinking this tea, doing a sweat lodge. You think you see God? You know, you do. But see, now the greatness is I see God without anything. And that's the greatness of life.
Sebastian Alvarado with the Coffee and Football Podcast, a long-form interview where I sit with some of the most influential profiles in the game to learn about their lives and career journeys. This week's guest is Martin Jacobson, known to many as Coach Jake, a legendary New York City profile and the coach of one of the most successful high school teams in the country, the Martin Luther King Jr. High School, a team consisting of incredibly talented kids from underprivileged inner-city areas and immigrants from all over the world. This is as much a story about someone who's gone through the lowest points, recovering from drug addiction and personal tragedies, as it is about a man who has devoted his life to help coach and guide disadvantaged kids to a better future. It's a remarkable story you really need to hear to believe. We ended up chatting for over 2 hours, so I decided to divide this one into two parts. So without further ado, here is part one of my interview with Coach Jake. Coach, it's a great honor to have you here. I've heard about you throughout the years from many people, so I'm very happy that we finally made it happen. So let me formally welcome you to Coffee and Football.
Oh, thank you, Sebastian. It's an honor to be here. Lovely place and great day. Great day for me to be here.
How are you doing today?
You know, I wake up at this ripe age and just glad I'm alive and feel good. No ailments. And chock full of energy.
Is that what most days look like for you? Because you seem to be a pretty positive character.
I wake up happy every day. You know, unless there's an unfortunate loss of a championship or something, then I'm miserable. I don't wake up miserable even if we lose a game or as a coach. But I do wake up ecstatically glad to be alive. My life is good right now.
What are the keys to that positive attitude?
Well, you know, you got to look at your background. You know, no one's background's been easy. No one said it'd be easy. You know, I always remember this quote. In my 30s and early 30s, I lived in New Mexico. I was running long distances, still playing a lot of soccer. And I ran up to a mountain. And out of nowhere, I looked down. There's a brass plaque. And it says, nobody said it'd be easy. And I couldn't believe it. I don't think I ever forgot that. Every day you just wake up feeling good. Listen, everyone has soap operas. Everyone has ups and downs. I have dysfunction in family. I've got a lot, if I dwell on the negative, to think about and be miserable and take, you know, all kind of antidepressants. That's just not in my DNA, let's just say. And I'm very happy to be alive. And what I'm doing, I love. I spent a lot of years as a 43 years as a professional educator. Everyone calls me professional, but I was an educator. and it's been a good ride. It's been a good ride. It's especially good when you're plus 70 and you're feeling the way you do and, you know, able to still work out and feel good and have positive energy and love being around kids. And things are positive right now in my life.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, it's very contagious. So you get people around you going as well. So how would you describe the workplace where you're at today?
Well, this is the way it is. I spent all these years at a high school, inner city high school, the last 30 plus. It's had its problems, its ups and downs, but the one thing I've developed is a fantastic program. It's not just a team. And for years, I worked as a guidance counselor, a dean, administrator in athletics. And what I did 6 years ago is took that wonderful pension of mine and said, that's it, no more dean work. Because if anybody knows what a high school dean does, it's I was working with two types of kids, my wonderful soccer kids, that had their own problems and we dealt with, and the kids that basically are not functioning well in school. So I have the well-functioning and the not-functioning. So all day I deal with the kids that would have to go on suspension or, you know, who knows, could be a weapons violation. It's New York City. And so it was interesting. And 6 years ago to this date, I do not have to go back and be a dean. Now, I was a guidance counselor included in that, an administrator, but that in athletics, but overall, right now, I go into work and I have an office and I deal with athletics. I see the kids every day, but I don't have to go into 12 or 1. And guess what? I can come here and talk if I don't want to go into work. And that is why it makes things better in my life.
And today is kind of a bit of an odd day for you because you don't have any practice really. Because other than that, it seems like you have a very, very busy schedule. You know, what's a typical day for you? So take me through kind of from the moment you get up, what time do you get up, what types of routines do you have, and then from there on.
Well, you know, it depends on what's scheduled on there, you know. The occasional doctor appointment, occasional situation with one of my children. Basically, it's 5 to 5:30 rise. It's look at yourself in the mirror and say, thank you, God, for another day. My partner, she sleeps. You know, but she's very good. She doesn't listen to me. I have a computer in this. We have a small, typical New York City two-room apartment. And I have a computer that just has headphones, so we don't have to worry about noise. And I get right on my computer. And then the New York Times gets delivered, and that's a must. The liberal that I am. You know, eventually get to read a little bit of that. And I drink a little coffee. Drink 3 glasses of water and about 40 vitamins when I get up. I'm on a vitamin regimen because of some of my past ailments. And I start immediately with emails and correspondence because I'm going through so much. I also have a team app that gets notices to all the team in case I want to give them a little extra nudge, like good luck today in the beginning of school. But everything's automatically listed in games and practices. Mostly that. Then got to work out a little bit. And since I tore the left shoulder out with the rotator, you know, I do bands. I do sit-ups, bands. I have a stationary bicycle in my house. I do that. Sometimes I will do go stop everything, go take a nice hour walk. It just depends because the thing is, but eventually I'll end up back at school. So the good thing about my schedule and retirement is I'm able to end back at school, of which is a soccer office, and you must see it. It's beautiful. It's great. And it's small, but it's they kids every day, whenever I'm there, if I'm not out of town or something, from the 6 floors in the building, and it's a big building, come and see me after school every single day, season or no season. And that's about 30 to 40 kids.
In getting in on that, on MLK, tell me a little bit, like, what kinds of kids do you get into the program? And maybe even backing up a little bit and get an understanding of how do they get there and what does that selection process look like?
Okay, so what we have in the New York City public schools at this current time, what MLK High School was a large, large urban comprehensive high school. Now, your listeners overseas might not understand the educational system, but New York City came up with this plan that they're going to disband all large urban high schools. And on each floor of the high school, they're going to make a school. So literally MLK became MLK Educational Campus. So on each floor is a different theme. let's just say. So that's an understanding that people have to understand that. So we have the Hunter High School for Science, right? Hunter Manhattan, Hunter Science High School. Number one rated high school in New York City. It's better than Stuyvesant and this, and my arch rival Beacon doesn't even compare to what we have. 400 kids, hard admission, bright kids. And then we have a high school for law. We have a high school for art and tech. We have a high school for urban studies, urban media, a music school in the building. So each floor. So what I do is then I go around and I work with distinct clubs. Manhattan Soccer Club, one of the main clubs, one of the higher level clubs in the city. And Asphalt Green now is coming live. They're coming live as a program. And I know the coaches there. One of them helps me with my program. We have Central Brooklyn, one of my top kids from the islands. He coaches a great program. Central Brooklyn Soccer is really good. So I'm able to go and say, okay, why don't you apply to these schools? And New York City has an open enrollment system. Any kid, first choice, any choice they make, they have to apply. They try to get in one of these schools. And I talk to the counselor. I talk to things. And I said, just apply. We'll get you in, you know. And these are players that are targeted. And it's legal under the Department of Ed policy to ask your kid to come to your school from 8th to 9th grade. So I meet the kids in 7th or 8th grade. Then I get a huge amount. Or a fair amount, I shouldn't say huge, of family members, of kids who played for me or coaches. I've got this one guy in the Bronx, runs a small league, Donovan, my coach Donovan. Jamaican National just came over. You know, how can I get him into your school? So I says, well, you know, go to the enrollment office and request a school because kids are allowed choices. Now, a lot of people say, well, they shouldn't be allowed for soccer. Well, why not? Why not? Why shouldn't you be allowed for anything if you're part of a program that's going to get you an education? Look, I got a 96% plus graduation rate. I've got 20 professionals who played for me, and I got hundreds in every college you can imagine, from UConn to St. John's to Bradley to Virginia to North Carolina State to Little Bethel in Indiana, which is an NAIA school, to Bethel in Tennessee, which is an NAIA school, where kids get free money and their lives have changed. And why shouldn't they come if they're that caliber of player? And not everyone is, but that's what we bring on. And the kids seem to be happy to be part of this process.
And you get kids from quite a few different backgrounds. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yes. It's here, the dynamics of the team changes. Sometimes it's more Hispanic. Sometimes it's more Caribbean, I should say. Sometimes it's West African. I mean, I've got kids from Eastern Europe, too. I mean, I get them all, which is nice. So my boys this year's, like, for instance, this year's team, quite a bit of West Africans this year. Last year, more of the island boys. You know, the year before, more Central and South American boys, and then the smithering of the others. You see, our sport does not have barriers. A sport does not have color. A sport is colorblind. It's ethnic blind. It's culturally blind. It's about talent. It's about love. It's about the passion that they all exist. It does not matter what they are. I don't know if I even think about it, you know. I just know that's the dynamics of the team. 20 years ago on the bus, you'd see the Hispanic boys hanging out by themselves and island boys all in the back making noise, you know, and then the West African kids looking at books, you know, and just trying to learn the language, you know. And now we go on that same bus. They're all kind of mixed together. And isn't that what we're about? And it's nice to see the changes. And not to say culturally they don't talk in French or Wolof or Mandingo or they do. They speak their language. You know, one year I had five Ghanaians and all of a sudden I have no Ghanaians. You know, you just don't know the breakdown, you know. But I do know they get on the field and it does not matter to them who starts, what shade they are. We're just happy to see that.
How would you say that? Because these kids come from all kinds of backgrounds and different socioeconomic statuses. And I can imagine that you're dealing with many more challenges, even off the field types of challenges versus an all white school in a more privileged area, sort of.
Well, one of the more privileged schools is one of our main competitors. For some reason, the Department of Ed has decided to, you know, give them a new school, give them, I don't know, you know, but it's typical of this country, unfortunately, of the educational system, how it's not, let's so-called say, so equal, just, and fair. But what we have, many of my kids have economic need. That's why they get a lot of financial aid to go to college. you know, at times I have to help out families. If you don't have some, can't pay your rent or you have no food on the table, what are you going to do?
So what do you do? How do you help them?
Well, you know, probably, you know, it'll come under some NCAA misdemeanor, you know, to say that I help. So I don't, you know, I won't get specific. Just to say I find benefactors to look out for them, you know, so we can say it's me, you know. Someone might help them out, wise, you know. I also, you know, have and will assist and continue to assist, especially in today's climate, with any legal needs that are needed for immigration status, especially with the current administration. And I'll be an advocate for that on a very big scale, but actually on a quiet scale, too, because then I'm just going to take care of this, these kids that play for me the best I can, if I can. And nowadays, more of my kids are born here or have full status here. So that's good. But there are half a dozen, at least, maybe more, that I have to assist in the immigration process. So I always, you know, worked, you know aware of it. And it's a slow process. But I have a lawyer who is... let's just say on call.
This would be a long conversation in itself, but if we touch on it briefly, because it is a complex subject, but what are your feelings in today's political landscape and reality that we're in relation to what you're doing? Because you're, to your point, you're dealing with and working with a lot of these kids and families and neighborhoods that are, you know, directly affected by some of these policies that are put in place.
Well, I, like I said, I'm not going to hide my my political beliefs.
Well, I think this goes beyond. I
mean, yes. It goes beyond it. It deeply is rooted in me as a first generation immigrant, or a second generation in my case. But it does not matter. It's civility, decent humanity, kindness. What happens? What happens here? A year ago. A little over a year ago, I had a boy from Ecuador. He was coming over here, and I met him. Great kid. He was my center forward. He was going to be a starting striker last year, 2016. And he did the right thing. He had a visa, a visitor visa. And because you're not allowed an I-20, a student visa, because if you go to public school, I don't know why not. But, you know, this is similar to what's going on now with the DACA. This is similar to what's going on now with the people's giving.
So if you go to a public school?
Yeah, you can't get an I-20, man. It's, no, not allowed. You can have to be in a private school, pay all this money to go to high school. This is high school. Not that college is the same thing, the I-20, which you're familiar with.
I am.
Yes.
Well, I'm one of the lucky ones who got into a private school on a scholarship and got a visa that way. So.
Yeah, but you went to college for that.
Yeah.
But this is high school. So high school doesn't permit that. So any kid that doesn't have it, so they come over and they're here and they figure, well, you know what? I've got a visitor visa. I'll go back because you're required to go back every 4 months, I think. It's something like that on the visitor visa. And I'll go back, visit family, and come back again. And this was, he was doing great in school, learning English. Everything was perfect. And he gets to the, Kennedy and they pull him right out. And they look at him and say, oh, and I think at that point he's 18, and they say, let me have your phone. They take his phone. They call his aunt, says, what school does he go to? This is the school. Duplicitousness on their part. They go to the school. They call her aunt and say, oh, he goes to Martin Luther King. And they take him and they lock him up for like 3 days at Kennedy Airport, revoke his visa, and send him back to Ecuador. And that just happened a year ago. Okay. So you ask me if that didn't break my heart. I don't know what did. You know, that this is one of them. He's not the first kid I had that's been deported. That's the most recent. He wasn't deported. He was just allowed an entrance and now can never come back for 10 years minimum. You know, see, their opportunity was that this kid would be here. We'll get him into an I-20 into college and then we'll continue keeping them here and then, you know, whatever reason, get permanent residence with the grace, if he gets lucky. Permanent residence. That's our goal. So then I have kids who have been homeless here, you know, over the years. And fortunately, some foster agencies took them in and they were able to get it, you know. There are a lot of stories that I have and certain stories I don't share because I don't want everybody to know my little secrets, you know. But I'll go all the way out to do anything I can to save the play. Look, I can't save the world. I cannot save every child. I can't save the 780,000 people that this darn president has decided to revoke, and this Jeff Sessions character, his henchmen, and this nonsense, and it's disgusting, it's disgraceful, it's inhumane. That's part of it. I have kids under that, okay? There are kids that played for me that I'm very aware of that have come under that presidential order that President Obama put forth. I am not going to tell you that I'm anything but against this whole situation. Again, I can only save who I can save. And the old adage, you save one life, you save the world. It's from the days of the Holocaust, which I'm very familiar with as a person of that ethnic background myself.
Not only have you built a great program and helping a lot of people, but you've turned it into perhaps the most successful high school team around. Well, I'd like to understand, how have you gone about building this?
You remember we touched back a little bit on the U.S. soccer, you know? Well, what you got to do is you get into people's hearts, you know? You make them believe in themselves. So it's not just tactics. It's not just some goalie coach directing the United States national team that I don't think is the greatest, you know? It's not like that, you know? It's not the guy from Germany who wins the World Cup that thinks he's going to import players and do this and that. Don't get me wrong. There's structural need. There's importance to training and certain ways to coach, you know, and do that. But like I say, our program is as good as anybody's, you know. I've been fortunate enough to have, you can't win without talent. Let's just face it. So why are we winning? Well, like I say, I get good kids that come and we develop them. They come in ninth grade. They come to me at 13, 14. Hey, listen, stick around, buddy, you know. Oh, as an example, I have a kid playing for the Cosmos named David Diosa, just one of them. I had a kid who played at Hartwick and was an All-American, Stephen Amaya, okay? They didn't see the field till their 11th grade year. You know, we build it. We build the character. We build the love. We always call it King Heart. I build a development and a thing called, you have to have heart for this school. You have to have heart for this program. You have to be extra special. No field, no funding, no bus, no locker room. We change our clothes on the field. We don't have a locker room at school to go in the back of the school and practice. We just don't have it. They change in my office. They change anywhere you can. Let's go over there. Just change in a corner. Unfortunately, sometimes you have to urinate in a corner. You know, I mean, that's who we are. But the King Heart is what you do. So I developed what I say. It starts with great talent. I recognize it. I can tell you talent in 10 minutes or less.
What are some of the things you look at?
Gait. How does that kid run? What kind of gait do you have? What kind of ability do you have? Athletic ability do you have at all? What do you look like? If I see a kid stiff and lean, and I can tell a kid's gait right away, you know? Then we go to touch. Let's see if it has a touch. Let's put him over here with this. Just yesterday, I got a kid from Brazil. Brazil, couldn't believe it. His dad is telling me, nice family. Dad's telling me how great he is. You know, he'll make my third tier, you know? But he should make the team because maybe next year he'll develop. Maybe that kid like Stephen Amaya or David Diosa, who didn't see the field and is now a Cosmo, who didn't see the field and went on to full four-year scholarship until their junior year, maybe he'll be a senior player. He's got enough to develop, you know? You just don't know. But you develop the heart. You see the gait. You ask me, what do I look at? Yeah, the gait. It's almost the first thing I look at is, how does that kid run? The next thing is, how does that kid touch the ball on a quick touch? Look at how he's turned. Look at how he turns his body. How does he touch the ball? I think the key is running and touching. Anybody can shoot a goal. Anybody can shoot on goal. Not everybody, but, you know. And then you look, if he's got left foot, right foot, what has he got? Dominant foot. I got a couple of players that are all dominant left. Doesn't make them bad players. So I look at those kind of things when we develop, you know. And then you ask back, is what I do is we take our talent, which God gives them, not me, their own passion. But it takes also, you know, their mindset. You know, we have to create more of a mindset for them. They have to believe that they're King Soccer and that they're something special. But, you know, you just look at it, develop it, you get the talent, and then you, from there, you develop the heart, the soul, and the spirit that's necessary to win in soccer.
I I want to shift gears a little bit and rewind the tape and learn a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up?
I was born in a hospital in Brooklyn, and my family, when first migrated to the Long Island and a little town called Long Beach on Long Island.
Where did they come from?
My family came from Eastern Europe, Prussia, Russia, Lithuania, that area. Their parents fled the pogroms of the Russian pogroms, and we arrived in New York City like many immigrants through Ellis Island, and I believe my name was Jakubowski. You know, Jakubat, something like that. And then there was Jacob and his sons. That was my grandfather. I had 10 brothers. And so it was Jacob and his sons. And I think that's how the name Jacobson came around. My mom was also brought over here and met my dad. And they were first generation. And they, again, chose to move to Long Island. They were the first ones out there. And a lovely little beach town. I love it to this day.
How would you describe your upbringing?
Economically in need. Dad got very sick, so he lost his job. My mother had to work 7 days a week as a beautician.
As a what, sir?
Beautician, a hairdresser.
Okay.
You know, which later in life affected her, all those dyes and all that stuff. And she passed at 94. My dad passed at 53.
What did your dad work with?
Dad worked in the garment district, and then he lost the ability to work there. Then he drove a cab, and then he died. And being brought up was mostly a matriarchal family, and we got very sick. And I passed away, and that's where I was, you know, on the streets, you know. And so we economically, no silver spoon in this mouth, you know, at all. Maybe that helps me recognize what these kids are going through. We had food on our table and not a lot of things, you know, but we had a house, a little tiny house, was probably bought for $12,000 back then, and that was it, you know. Nice school system, great friends, great life, no complaints, except one day I was getting in trouble throwing pebbles into cars and, you know, just mischievous more than delinquent, but yet I did shoplift and do things that little kids do at 11. 12 years old, 11 years old. So the police picked me up and took me to the recreation center on Long Island. And this is one of my favorite stories. And there was a man there named Herman Druckmann. Can't ever forget him, you know, Holocaust survivor. But my emigrated from Brazil back to the States here. Germany, Brazil, here. And he ended up, I didn't know until a little later in life, he was an all-American from Cortland State. Very, very little German accent. And you want to learn to play soccer? And I said, yes, why not? I was, that's the police officer took me to him. And back then, it makes it ironic to me that we started learning to play soccer, and I got pretty good at it. And we were using cones. They were no goalposts. And the soccer shoes were old football cleats. And I mean, the high rise, high top football cleats with big giant studs in them. And I got pretty good at it. And by the time I was in high school back then, they had a high school team. And I got to start my freshman year. And then I went on to college to play. But Herman Druckmann, he may not know, but his just introduction to the sport of love, the beautiful game, and all these wonderful acronyms we use, it was it. Passion was born. So that was always an enlightening little story that the Holocaust survivor taught me the game.
What kinds of dreams did you have?
You know, I'm not sure as a cognitive mind that kids have today. I just kind of was a dreamer rather than, you know, like a daydreamer more than a dreamer, you know. I knew one thing. I always wanted to be a gym teacher, and that goal got fulfilled. You know, my bachelor's degree is in physical education. I always felt that the guy coaching me in high school, and we had three different coaches, didn't know shit, and that I could become a better coach. That I knew. That I want to be a gym teacher and coach soccer. Yeah, I always wanted to. And it's amazing that back then I was 15 or so when I said, yeah, I want to be a gym teacher. You know, I didn't have the grades for Cortland State, but somehow I got out to Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. And there was a coach from New York City, New York area, Long Island, was coaching out there. And somehow I ended up there. And back then, not scholarships, you know, I mean, I was able to get a graduate grant and I was able to get a little cut off on my as tuition, like they gave me the last couple of years in-state tuition versus out-of-state. So to make up a lie and say it was a full scholarship, there are no such things, you know.
So you did your bachelor's in phys ed and you went on to do a master's as well?
Yeah, I got a master's in counseling. They gave me a grant to go there. I went back a couple of years later after the hippie days, traveling the country after not getting drafted. So I had a high lottery number. Back then it was Vietnam War and all the time. And I was kind of a hipped out, you know.
What was that? Like, what was the lottery?
Well, what it is I started teaching in 1968. Started coaching soccer and wrestling and everything in New York. And by 1970, they stopped deferments. Back then, it's a little history in life in the Vietnam War, and most people were against it. Bottom line is I was gone to Brooklyn for the physical. I was in line to be drafted. And then the next thing you know, they said, you know what? We're going to put a lottery out there. And when your birthday gets picked, that's when you go. You know, and they picked 190 birthdays that were going to go, and I was 310. So I was teaching, and I said, you know what? I'll go travel the country. And I was, into some, fun times, let's just say. The times of marijuana and drugs and all that was really increasing. And I decided to travel. And then I was out of money. And I went back to Indiana, to Ball State. And they had an opening, which is interesting. I'll never forget it. They needed to hire a white person in a black program, basically. It was what's that called? The affirmative action. But it wasn't affirmative action. But it was a tumultuous time in the 1970s. It was tough in 1970. It was a time of political turmoil and things like that. But I got selected, and it was great. I made $250 a month, and they gave me free tuition, and I got my master's degree with a 4.0, maybe 3.5, something. But there it goes from the 68 average. You go to that, it's pretty good. And now by 1971, I had my degree. And back then, there were some things that went on at college, and you dealt drugs to make money, and you protested the administration, but I worked in a program predominantly of kids who were taken out of the inner city of Gary, Indiana, and Chicago, and given a chance to succeed in college, and they needed to hire for the federal program. Somehow, it was me, So it's interesting, Again, I'm colorblind, so it didn't matter to me. It's just that they gave me the job.
Tell me about the hippie trip.
Hippie trip was like the Volkswagen van jumping. Well, actually, that time it was a Ford van. It was around the country, out to San Francisco to deal with my friend who was a major LSD dealer, meeting up with him, doing all kinds of drugs at that time, recreational fun, I'd call it, partying, and then coming back to Indiana. It was just like I went through all the Idaho and this area and that area, and then I went back. And what happened, if we can follow the sequence of things, going back to the masters, like I talked about, then over to Detroit and just saying, you know what? I need to get out of here. I just can't deal with it anymore. I can't be stuck in this job. Let me move across to another place. And I didn't know where I was going to go. I took all my belongings, and I was with somebody at the time, the mother of a couple of my children, and then left it and just got in a car. So the story is this. So I'm in Detroit, and I'm still not coaching soccer, coaching wrestling. They didn't have any soccer back then. It's an area right outside Detroit, Trenton. And rented a house from a police officer. It was a funny story, And I was in the park smoking marijuana. And I ran into this guy, Ted. Won't use his last name because, what if he's still 70 years old himself and alive? And he was worked in the Ford Motor Company, and we started talking. He said, do you know if I can get some LSD? And so my friend in California, we're talking a major LSD deal. And I said, yeah, sure, man. I'll get you some, and I need to supplement my income. And this is how I afforded to leave teaching and go forward. Anyway, I was able to start selling 10,000 hits of LSD about every 2 weeks. And it was a Mr. Natural LSD. And it was interesting how any car, I always laugh again, how did any car get manufactured? If the Ford Motor Company is buying this stuff and all the guys on the assembly line are taking LSD, or they got manufactured beautifully. So I took the proceeds of that money, and I just said, you know what, I'm putting everything on the porch. It's an old house. I'm lucky that the policeman, his name is Bob E., well, he's got to be passed on by now, know that in the basement of this house, this old house, was like I would be shipping out thousands of dollars, and I'd be getting thousands of dollars and getting hits, and I had all this money in cash. I felt like a major, obviously not such a good drug dealer, but it was LSD back then. It was a day of LSD. You know, it was the days of psychedelic drugs. It was the days of party. It was just the era in the 70s. And so, and I lived a double life. I was also a very highly successful wrestling coach. I won all these matches and it was good. But, you know, I had this dichotomy. I had this duality, let's just say. And so from there, we went out. And that's when I discovered New Mexico and, worked out there.
And then what happened out west?
Well, partied and all that. And I drove down to, lived in, camped out in Aspen for a good 6 weeks. And I started saying, you know, I better go back to teaching. And I got some offers out west in Colorado. And I drove to Santa Fe. And this is 1974 by that time. And I just fell in love with it. I also was a believer in God, you know. And I went up and prayed on the top of a mountain every day. I was camping out in a Black Canyon campground on the outskirts of Santa Fe. And every day I go, but God. I visualized because I believe in visualization. I believe in God. I went through all the trainings of mind control programs, they're called, and things. I went through a spiritual path at that point. When I started doing the psychedelics, I also believed that there was a very great power beyond me. And that power sustained me to this day. And the belief of, you ask me why I'm positive, it always kept evolving my positive energy. Some of them artificially with drugs, but most of them not. And I got a job out of 2,000 applicants. I got a job at Santa Fe High School as a guidance counselor. Living there was it's heaven. It's a land of enchantment. It was beautiful. It's everything I wanted. That's where I lifted my soul. That's where I bottomed out my soul in the same place. Got a job at Santa Fe High. And within 2 years, I started the first high school program in the state of New Mexico, a public school. And it was a battle. Again, place to practice, fight the administration. They only want football. I got in a fist fight with the athletic director one day. However, I did start this program. I spent 10 and a half years in Santa Fe until I was run out of town.
You've mentioned it here a little bit, and you've been very open with it, going from kind of the recreational drugs to getting it, making it into an addiction. How did that happen?
We seem to be talking about evolving a lot here, you know? Things evolve. So here we go to the evolution of a drug addict. I was doing a lot of stuff. You know, I ended up being director of high school guidance in Santa Fe, New Mexico, soccer coach in the front page of Santa Fe, New Mexico all the time, leading the team to many wins, built the program, pioneered it and all that, played it. For heaven's sake, we were in the Albuquerque Soccer League. I started the co-ed league in Santa Fe. I started the Santa Fe. I was very involved in this thing. And then I had bought, I lived on a place 7.2 acres outside of town. It was beautiful. Cañada de los Alamos was the name. I built a home. Remember, I had all this drug money, so I was able to buy something. This is the ironic part, is how you win and lose on that, you know? And yeah, I was able to move, leave, because I made all that money in LSD. So it was a great time of my life, you know? I ended up buying 5 homes. I ended up being well-known in the community as a leader and all in this, but always looking for something. The problem with feeling good, sometimes you want to feel better. And that's what I realized. I felt good. I wanted to feel better. What was that better going to look like? What drug could take me to that better? So beside our LSD parties and all this and things like that, and I still would take a little bit of that, and the old days was called Quaaludes. I'm probably, some of your listeners are going to remember this stuff. You know, they can remember the real, you know, the pure cocaine that you snort and the Valium to take you down and the psilocybin mushrooms that I took on tops of mountains to hear God's music, you know, which I did. But all the along, remember, I am the director of high school guidance and the soccer coach. But I sat in a tent with the Indians smoking peyote and OSHA, because OSHA just stops you from getting sick, drinking this tea, doing a sweat lodge, you know. You think you see God, you know, you do, you know. But see, now the greatness is I see God without anything. And that's the greatness of life, evolving.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You talk about that drive that you had, that you wanted more and you wanted to be happier. And where do you think that comes from?
From a lack of satisfaction, a lack of strong ego, and not a, not ego is the word, self-esteem. I think that would be the correct word. Let's just use that word. Lack of great self-esteem, right? Lack of, you know, thinking, you know, because deep down rooted insecurity is what creates that, you know? So regardless of how secure you seem, some people really are insecure. It's not something people would say about me now at all. But yeah, feel good and you want to feel better and you turn to drugs. And that's as simple as it gets, you know? And that's where that was going. And, you know, so far so good as recreational. I wasn't always there, you know, but then I ran into this woman, and I hate to say it's a damn woman, you know, but I don't want to be sexist. I don't want to be anything. But I ran into a woman who said to me, listen, it's your birthday party. And we always had this huge, you could imagine, 100 people coming to a place. I lived in the mountains, and it was a great place. And I had all this land. We had a volleyball court. And they came out to my birthday party, which is, in May, late May, and school is over out there in May. And all these people come and you drink and you do drugs. And this is, remember, the years, you know. Now, this is the 80s already. And they come out and there I was, you know. She says, would you like to try something? It's my birthday. Why not, you know? So she takes out a needle and she takes out a tie and she shakes it up. And this is called Dilaudid. Now, people don't know what Dilaudid is. It's a synthetic heroin. And you shake and bake it, it's called. See, this is a drug, the lesson in drugs here, you know. It's still around to ingest, and shaking bacon is incredible, you know. It shakes down, and you just shake it and shoot it, and you shoot it up, and you mainline it. And I'm sitting there, it's my birthday party, hundreds of people out. She takes me to the bathroom, she shoots me up with this and goes, whoa, and a rush comes over your body. It was a well-known drug before OxyContin. Because that's what they were doing with OxyContin. So it's as strong as or was. And they still actually use it at times for pain. But it, obviously, mine must have been emotional pain because that's all I used it for. So I took this. That was it. I think I was addicted in a day. I just think I got addicted that minute, you know. And then she started coming around more and more.
What kinds of effects?
It was a euphoric effect that these people are feeling on this heroin these days. This is why it's so unique, you know. And then we started hanging out. It was the summer, so it was easy for me. I wasn't coaching. I was trying to play soccer a little bit, which I love. We were in the summer leagues, and I was getting ready to coach again. Things were good, you know. But, that right there became my ecstasy of drugs. It was a downer. It wasn't the cocaine. It wasn't the LSD. It wasn't all the stuff that I had experimented with. It was recreational. And from there, we continued on this, you know, very dysfunctional relationship, you know, but based around drug addiction. And right there and then, the next thing, within 7 days, you could feel the withdrawal, you know, if you didn't have your fix. There was a doctor in Española, New Mexico, that was giving them out like candy. And so we would drive up there, tell the doctor my foot hurts. Each of us get 10 of those. They'd last a while and then you're out. The doctor ends up getting, I'm shortening the story. The doctor ends up getting busted. Now I'm with this woman saying to you, what can you get for me? What can you get for me? That's when Mexican tar heroin was around. Okay. And I was in New Mexico. Next to tar heroin would come up. And it's black heroin tar. It was like more tar. I remember it. And that's when I started shooting up heroin, you know, because I needed something not to be sick. And that's when things started costing much more money. And that's when my whole life began to fall apart incredibly fast. Furious, for the next 2.5, almost 3 years, I lost everything.
How were you financing it? Were you selling off your property? And
ironically, yes. You know, whatever savings I had, my habit was between 100 And sometimes when I quit teaching, I mean later, $1,000 a day. Yeah, shocking, isn't it? Shocking.
At that time.
At that time. Yeah, yeah. That was a pretty sad time in my life. You know, it started out with the 2550 thing. Then all of a sudden, I'm selling a picture. I'm paying some guy. You know, I got real close to this this Spanish Indian named Geronimo. He was my drug buddy. You know, I'm running the first camp, the Sangre de Cristo soccer camp. No one ever ran it before. Probably the first camp in New Mexico for soccer in the summer. You know, and I'm starting to do all these things. You know, and all these things, and they get back to work and. You work to score and you score to work and you live to score and you know, that's all you do is you live to the next day. And it was a pattern that it started that day at my birthday. I would say it was about my 34th or 35th birthday. It's hard to say exactly. My mid 30s, here I am. Now I'm totally addicted, you know, to heroin. I try to go to work. I'm shooting up in the bathroom. I'm leaving school at noon. Now, it was a campus school that had a place. I'm running across, I'm taking my car, going to the middle of the Sangre de Cristo projects. Okay? And in those projects is Viejo Joe and Margie, a couple. And I'm buying dope. I'm in that project. I got stabbed in those projects in my hand, right through my hand, you know? This started to evolve to like a real nightmarish life, you know, as I recollect it. You know, as I go back now, I can talk about it.
Right.
But when you're going through it, all you care about is where am I getting that fix? Because you really do withdraw. So here's a span of my life. I'm probably better off forgetting, but it might be good that I recall it for those who are listening or anyone that knows there's hope. There's redemption in life. There really is. There really is redemption. But there I was, a hopeless drug addict. Director of high school guidance, first high school soccer coach until I lost, you know, they didn't fire me, but.
Did they realize what was going on?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I got arrested for forgery and fraud while I'm a teacher.
What kind of fraud?
Oh, I was check kiting. I was sending, making checks. Back then, there was not the system they have now in computers. Forging prescriptions, you know, I was doing a lot of stuff, you know, that, because why? Because when you're in that situation, which this country's got to realize through all these people that are having the same difficulties they're having now that I had, you only care about that because you're so helplessly addicted, so helplessly strung out. I always say I didn't have a monkey, I had a gorilla on my back. You know, that's what I was going through.
Did you get into trouble? Did you get arrested? Like
I was doing anything to score. So the way it worked was this. It was a 3-year process, you know. But I was still at school, still working, going over there, scoring, going to the bathroom, scoring. Very functional drug addict. I loved it, you know. It was the ecstasy of drugs. Felt great. Go back, be a counselor, very popular counselor, you know. And then living alone at that time with one of my children. My other child left, the ones I have now, in a place in the mountains where that party was, and try and take care of her, which wasn't very successful. All I cared about was scoring. Would go at lunch from playing racquetball with the governor of New Mexico to being a drug addict. You know, so instead of going to play racquetball at lunch, which I used to do, and I was good at it, I earned up to an A player. And this is my early 30s. Then now I'm running to score and go back to school and do all that, you know. Like I say, from very high esteemed, very well liked, very well known to that. So, yes, what happened a few times was I would maybe write a check, forge a check, steal money, do this stuff like that. Never got caught. The biggest one was an interesting, horrible, horrendous story. No one ever got hurt, so I can't say I harmed any human being. These are nonviolent crimes. This is what happened. At that time, I'm not working anymore. So I leave the school system voluntarily because they put me in a couple treatment centers. They don't work. You relapse, you go back. You relapse, you go back. I've been in treatment centers. I've been there. They try to help you, you know, and it doesn't work.
What do they do there? What kinds
of... Well, treatment centers are 12-step centers, you know. You first of all, you have to detox, you know, and that's hard, you know. And one place was out in Valley, and they put me for 30 days, you know. And the minute I got out, I relapsed. The minute I got out, the only thing you think about is how am I going to score again? These are the struggles that these people... that are currently in this situation, which numbers million at least in this country, are going to battle, you know, because it takes that extra something. I mean, I know I'm 1 in 1,000 that's clean from what I've done. You know, the treatment centers, different detox centers, different places, and I still go ahead and I forge it. I got caught forging a prescription. I steal a pad in the hospital and I forge it and I run out and go fill it up and run back to the hospital like I'm not there. I mean, I've done things that, unconscionable things, and the details are important as much as the devastation that I caused on myself and those around me who loved me. Then this one story, and this is one I did not get caught with, and I thought I would, and to this day, you know, statute's limitations are gone, and the drugstore is gone. So he says to me, get in the car. He goes into the drugstore.
This is Geronimo.
Yes, sir. And he robs the drugstore at gunpoint. So that's now you got serious stuff here. You know, that's not an easy thing. I was not in the drugstore. I was in the car. He said, let's get out of here. I go back to my place. Now, at this point in my life, I left teaching. When I said $1,000 a day habit, it was because I got $60,000 out of my pension. I didn't keep it in my pension. I started spending it like it was water. Because what do you know? You're never going to run out of $60,000 back in mid-80s. That's a lot. And I go and I drive the car. We come out. He comes out with bundles of drugs. We go to my place and nobody's around. My daughter's not around there at that point. We put a mattress on the window. I own guns. You know, hard to believe this nice little coach owned guns, you know? So... shotgun, guns, 45, you know. We blocked up the door, figured that was it. The police, state police are going to come. We're going to have a shootout and your life is over, but we don't care because we're shooting up all kinds of, you know, chemical cocaine, dilaudid, you know, codeine, you know, all this stuff. We're just doing all these drugs, you know, for days on end, you know. And then he never got caught. He never got caught, you know. One of the good horror stories of life. Or the bad ones, I would say, rather than the good ones. The ones I remember is not a good one. It's just one that I ended up. So I did get a couple times arrested in a local jail for using, what was it, kiting, check kiting, and which means you're writing a check against another account that's not there. But, you know, nowadays that's hard to do. But back then you could. And then, like I say, the charges were, you know, not paying checks, bouncing checks all over the place, making up stuff. Back then it was, you know, just to get that $50, $100, whatever it was. So eventually... that was the time when I was unemployed. Now, you said you sold everything. I sold my kitchen sink. I literally tore apart the house. I had these custom-made cabinets. I pulled them out, and I sold it to somebody. I went know that these guys were breaking into houses, stealing stuff, and was I around for that? Yeah, you know. I mean, these are things that are horrendous. I hope the world does not think poorly of me, but these are the choices you make when you're a drug addict. And that's who I was. That's not who I am.
Yeah, and there's so many more of those types of stories. So many people who are sitting in prison for these types of things and not necessarily for violent crimes.
You know, I don't like to talk too much about the family because I have some dysfunction in my family. But I have a young daughter, my youngest, who's sitting in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility right now, who was a heroin addict. Who, because of where she was, because of Ulster County, not New York City, got put away for a while. Because if you're in New York City, they'll give you probation. You're in Ulster County, New York. They put away, you know, for $280 worth of drugs. And has spent the last 3 years in and out of prison, you know, and is due to get out soon. Now, I tried to help her a few times, and she went right back. So there's a struggle in my own family. And so I recognize this. Now, if she could, she knows about me, if... I can help her, be great. If I can help anyone out there realize that a change is possible, then God, that's great. You know, if I could change one life, just one, then this is all worth my story.
Clearly, the system doesn't work.
Punishment does not work.
Correct.
Punishment can't work. These
how do we change that?
These people, these, you know, they think that's the answer. It's just not going to happen.
But we keep saying that, but to my knowledge, that's the way we can continue handling these things and these people.
You know, I think, what was it, state Vermont? New Hampshire, I think, started a new program around treatment versus prosecution versus internment, or call it what you wish, jail. So I don't think there's a simple solution, but one thing is for sure. Filling the jails, because it's an economic thing. It's not, filling jails is not just punishment. It's to make money, yeah. It's communities that make money. It's these not-for-profit jails that make money. It's all about let's keep the jails full. And it's part of our horribly non-functioning government, state, local, and federal. And treat the source, you know, make these kids more whole, you know, make the world more whole, make them appreciate life, give them fulfilling lives, fulfilling jobs, get them at a young age, you know, and no simple solution. There's no doubt.
You're still in Santa Fe. You don't have a job. You've sold everything off.
Yes. Yes.
Then what happened?
Well, I was still pretty strung out and failed to do that. And I had a bit of a spiritual awakening. I said, I can't do it. I mean, you know, in the drug recovery program, they say you haven't bottomed out yet. That's a big term you hear. Well, guess what? I just bottomed out. I have a 13-year-old daughter. And no place to live. Well, I have a place to live. They foreclosed on the house, but wait until they kicked me out. Back then, so what I said is, you know, Mom, I'm coming home, you know, basically. But Mom was married to someone else by now. And the stepfather didn't want to hear, I'm coming home. But she did take my daughter. And then I flew back from New Mexico on an airline only your non-generation would understand called People's Airline. It was one of those discount airlines, okay? Back then, is you know, it's like, okay, for $59.99, you can get to New York. And I had $1.23 in my pocket. That was it to my name and the clothes I had on my back. And I Molly picked me up. I dropped Larry. She said, okay, you have to leave. I went, lived in the city a little bit, no place to live. And then I called my friend, you know, pretty much homeless. So I'm homeless, penniless. That's me. But I couldn't score if I wanted to. I had no money. And I'm feeling like shit, you know, like really bad because I'm still withdrawing. The doctor before I left gave me clonidine. Back then, they discovered this thing that if you take a low blood pressure pill, it stops the withdrawal syndrome. So that's what I started hitting. And it's not addictive, but what it is you feel no REMs, no rapid eye movement, no... you know, your blood pressure drops down, so you can't take it. So it's because it lowers your blood pressure. And at least you're not vomiting or trying to vomit or throw up. And so I started taking those and just to get through it. Then I called a friend in Long Island and said, can I sleep on your couch? And he said, yeah, come. An old friend who passed away by now, himself had his own problems, but he was clean. And he let me sleep over there. And from there was a long road to recovery. But homeless, penniless, for a little under, not a long time, but enough. Then sleeping on someone's couch and then bringing my daughter back to me and driving a cab. You know, that's what happened. I was able to keep taking these pills, going to meetings and praying that God, please give me the strength not to use today. God, give me the strength. Please don't let me use today. Please. And I would have dreams about drugs, and it was a battle. It was a battle, but I didn't have as much temptation. You know, that's where it all started to go. Now you go back in the other direction, but that period of my life, the 3-year period, 2.5-year period to 3 years, was tough. It's tough. It's tough to remember. It's tough to talk about it. To believe it. I don't even believe it. That's where I began. That's where the road to recovery began.
That really became the turning point then.
Yeah, big turning point. You know, so I drove a cab and I saw the New York Times back then and there were all these kids in trouble. I think it was crack era. Yeah, 86, 85, you know, 80s. And I saw an ad, special ed teachers needed. Well, you know, I still had a degree. I have no felony convictions. I was driving a cab and making money. I mean, I was riding the midnight shift. 6 at night to 6 in the morning.
In the city?
No, it was Long Island at that time. But I did some, you know, I was going to go to the city. It was in Long Island. Because that's where the guy gave me a place to live. So I did that. And she got a daughter in school. You know, she was 15 at the time, 14, 13 to 14. And I lived, you know, lived on this guy's couch. He let her stay there. And then someone let me live in an apartment for $250 every 2 weeks, you know, like basement, no furniture, nothing. Just someone gave me a mattress on the floor. but Grove. And so it's in. And I said, yeah, I'll apply it immediately. You know, you're kidding me? Certified, healthy male. Here, I'm going to put you in this room with these 13-year-old special ed students that are probably born from crack moms. I don't say they are. And it was tough. It was crazy. It was nuts. But I had an income.
Nuts in what way?
Well, remember, now, this is emotionally disturbed young boys. It happened to be boys. I could have had girls, but it happened to be have about, it was a K-8 school in East Harlem. So I'd have to pass the drug dealers that were selling heroin that I really wanted back in my life, but I stayed away from. Yeah, 120th Street. Not the greatest neighborhood in the world back in the 80s, you know. So they were throwing chairs through the room, crazy, you know, just out of control. And one thing was good is I was straight. I was healthy. And I was a male, you know. And it was, and I didn't know anything about teaching special ed. But remember, I had a guidance degree. I had a phys ed degree. And they kept me. Now, this is when it gets a little tricky. So here I am teaching. They love me. Everyone else quit. So no one's teaching this class. They all quit. And I just took it a day at a time with commute, long commute, and then continue to drive a cab Saturdays and Sundays. I'd wake up 6 o'clock in the morning. I should finish my shift. I go home, change. I go to work the next day, same day.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a tough one. But again, I had it's penniless, you know, I had to make money, you know, and then the Department of Ed, of course, screws your check up for a month or two. So you don't have any pay. So I had to make money as a cab driver. It was a tough time. But I was straight. That was the secret. I was straight and starting to feel my spirit back. And a guy would pick me up, take me during the week to an AA meeting. Yeah, so here I am. It's May, hot May. I get called down to the principal's office, right? Two detectives are sitting there. They say, you, Martin Jacobson. I says, yeah, yeah. He says, you have a warrant for your arrest in New Mexico. You're going to be extradited and taken back to New Mexico. And I go, I'm looking, I said, whoa. I'm looking and saying, oh my God. You know, I'm flabbergasted. Now, this is around 1985, let's say, okay? I'm teaching, I'm clean, I'm healthy, I'm, you know, popular again, getting my spirit back. Remember, you're spiritually bankrupt when you're a drug addict. Forget the economic for sure, emotionally for sure, screwed up, but spiritually bankrupt. You know, and but I had that. I still had my spirit. And I never forget. They couldn't believe it was me. So they take me in. They take me out of school in handcuffs. And it's the hottest day of the year. I can never forget. It was June. And they stick me at, they take me to One Center Street. See, you don't have to be a New York person to understand this. So One Center Street is where they take you and they put you in lockup. And now you're in lockup.
And that's just up the street here.
Yes, sir. And it's lockup with 20 other inmates. You, everything you've seen on TV, how they lock your feet and hands together and they march you, you know, similar to probably what Sheriff Joe does in Arizona, that asshole, you know. But, you know, I was accused of forgery and fraud, and I was facing 20 years in jail. That's what they told me. And that I had to be extradited back to New Mexico because there's an outstanding warrant. You see, when you get your teaching license, you take fingerprints. Well, the fingerprints take time to get back. So when the fingerprints came back, a red light or alert happened. The police get notified. I am now taken out of school into One Center Street and draws us there and then sent to the Tombs. I wasn't sent to Rikers because Rikers would have been next.
What's the Tombs?
The Tombs is the famous lockup in that area in One Center Street. The famous, famous Tombs. That's what they're called. I believe they're still there. So here I am, ethnically different, but spiritually together. And
what's going through your head when all of this is going down?
You know, pretty much blown away by this drama, you know, pretty much blown away by the drama and fear. I mean, I don't know what the hell's going on. I mean, they just took me out of school and put me into this horrendous setting, waiting for me to go in front of a judge, waiting to be extradited, not knowing what's going on.
For how long were you there?
I spent 3 days. I think on the fourth night I got out eventually. My mother, God bless her soul, found me, found a guy in the hallway. A lawyer says, represent my son, quick, you know, get him out. And they made an agreement. She gave him like, how many thousands of dollars, and made an agreement with New Mexico that I can come back on my own. So I wasn't extradited. And the Department of Ed, school year was over. I could never go back to teaching until I cleared this matter up. And they wanted me back. The school wanted me back. They were shocked, you know, and all this. But the charges were there. They weren't for the drugstore. They weren't for the breaking and entering. They weren't for any of that. They were for some of the checks I wrote. And they had the warrant. The warrant was written. You know, remember, I was quickly exited town. You know, there's a saying, you have to make amends. Well, guess what? I did not make amends on that one. And then it caught up. And, you know, being in that jail situation, because what it was so hot, you take off your shirt. I was getting strong again. Remember, I was young. And my body was strong, you know. And you take your shirt off and you sleep on your sneakers. You're laying on a floor with 20 other inmates until they sent you to the tombs, waiting to be processed to go back to go to Rikers. And it was just, you know, it's just kind of like a blurb now, you know, in my mind, because it's 30 years ago or more. But that was, you know, it's not so much going on my mind at the time. Fear, probably, you know, anxiousness. But you know what kept me? What keeps you? You're clean and you're getting spiritual enlightened. One of the highest moments of my life was, one, I wasn't going to eat the bologna sandwich they fed you. Two, the Kool-Aid was a sip. Three, fast and look for God. And that's what I did. I fasted and looked for God and asked for God's help. Because that's what saves you. And any time of crisis, who are you going to turn to? I'm a believer in God. You know, God, please help me out of this. Please, God, please, God, please, God. I kind of pray for championships that way too, believe it or not. Maybe God doesn't like soccer. Maybe he does.
Where does that strong belief come from?
You know, remember, I was a... I went on a path of spiritual enlightenment, you know, through the 70s. Took something called silver mind control. I meditated. I believed in a higher power. I developed this akin through LSD and through not LSD, through the ability of where we get what we want. We can create anything in our reality. We manifest reality through our spirit. I believe in all that stuff. And to this day, I still do. The practicing it, you know, the you know, like talking to God, believing that God's talking to you. I may be different. I may not be. But I think in times of crisis, we have to turn to some kind of spirit, some kind of higher energy level. And that's it, you know. And it sustained me through it. I got through it. They made me go back. They let me go back and to New Mexico on my own. I had to hire a lawyer. My mother helped me. You know, I had to fly back there. I have friends there, except also people want to kill me there too. So that was, you know, because I owed money for drugs, you know. So the drug addicts wanted to kill me if they found me.
How did you get out of this one?
Well, when they came in, I had some real strong letters of recommendation back then, nice typewritten letters that, you know, we didn't have computers back then, and I'd use a wide range of computers. And what it is a police officer that I knew from Long Beach. He wrote a beautiful letter. I had the principal of the school wrote this incredible, gleaming letter of what I was doing with kids. And they decided to give me a shot. They just said, you know what? You piss in this bottle. Piss in this bottle. You come out clean. No problem. Now, I didn't drink. I didn't do drugs. I was clean. So I didn't worry about pissing in a bottle. You know, I was clean. Actually, I had mouthwash that morning. I got scared. I thought maybe, you know, the mouthwash would go up. Bottom line, they came up. They offered me this system called pre-prosecution. You stay out of trouble. You'll go and take some, you know, you'll go urinate in a bottle at times during the first year. You're fine, which they never even asked me to urinate of that. They just left the state. They dropped the cases. They gave me, they didn't know, no convictions, no anything. They gave me clearance. I go back to the Department of Ed back then. It was called the Board of Education. I gave them all the documents. They reinstated me into class. And then the journey begins once again, you know, into school in East Harlem. And then in 1994, King came open. I said, that's it. I'm home. You know, what can I build? Build it and they shall come. And that's what happened since then. Now, I hope that makes chronological sense.
Absolutely.
But you hit me on my downside and my coming up. But those are some of the stories, the horror stories I have. And if I think deep enough, we can probably come up with a few more. But I think that'll do for now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe on iTunes and write a review. I would really appreciate it as we grow this podcast one listener at a time. If you have any feedback or ideas, feel free to send me an email at sebastian@coffeeandfootball.com. You can also link up with me via Twitter. The handle is @coffeesfootball. Stay tuned for next episode. It will be another amazing one. Thanks again and have a great week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.